Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on the COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During this edition of the show, we give you access to local physicians and public health experts with information on COVID-19 and recommendations related to it. If you have a question for our guests, please email it to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, another Dock of the Rock, another relatively great week for Kodiak and for the state of Alaska. But with some troubling issues lurking on the horizon, we're going to talk about some of those things and try to answer your questions again today. Due to time constraints with both panelists and myself, we're going to have to end just before 10 o'clock. So if you'd like to add the conversation into the conversation with a question, call 486-3181 or shoot me an email, lowdown@kmxt.org, and we'll try and get your questions answered before the end of the show. Also, a special note, we'll be having another special edition of The Lowdown this coming Monday. We'll be talking with the administrators at Providence, Kodiak Community Health Center, and CANA about the challenges they've been facing and how they're planning for what's coming up in the future at their individual organizations. If you have questions for that panel, please send them in before Monday morning. It has an area we've been very interested in talking about, but we're here with the medical professionals this morning. So please call your question in or shoot me an email this morning in regard to either one, and we'll try and get each panel to answer a question. Dr. Evan Jones is here from CANA and Dr. Curtis Mortison from the Kodiak Community Health Center. Morning, gentlemen. Thank you for your time again this morning.
Good morning.
You look like you're having great days so far.
Yeah. It's early.
Living the dream.
Are you morning guys? Are you tend to be morning people?
I was actually talking to my kids about this week because they said, "Do all daddies wake up this early?" And I'm a morning person through and through. So yes, this is prime time for me.
I have been forced to be a morning person, given my career choice. I'm not sure I am, though.
But you did some farming before, though, didn't you? I mean, aren't you guys notorious?
No, I've got no farming. No.
The perception seems to be, we're doing great. The numbers are coming way down all across the state. Hospitalizations are down. Locally, our reports, we're still reporting numbers, which is, as we talked about this before, where, one was a huge number before, and now four is, acceptable. But we're still seeing some community transmission. But people seem to be of the perception that we're over it. We've survived here in Kodiak. Is that your reading on how things are going, or are we just in a lull here?
I personally think that we're in a bit of a lull. We're not over it. We're moving in the right direction. I'm sure we've all read at this point that Alaska has more people vaccinated per capita than anywhere else in the U.S. And frankly, with exposures to COVID, it gives you some immunity also. So between the previous people getting sick and more people getting immunized, we're cutting down on the number of vectors that this disease can be passed through. I don't think this lull has too much to do with the vaccine yet because we started it too recently. But I do think it's more of a lull, and we still need to be a little bit cautious about how we handle ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking through this kind of in general. So it looks not everybody, this is not fully vaccinated, but I think about 10% of our population in Kodiak roughly has been at least given the first vaccine. Some of them have been given the second. And I don't know that there's been any sort of I don't think there's been any sort of study on Kodiak and at large as far as what percentage has actually been infected. You know, I think that we would probably say, you know, somewhere between 15 and 30% probably of our population has been infected with COVID. It's we don't really know that for sure. But if you look at that, you know, even if you took the most aggressive numbers of those infected, that still is only adds up to about 40% of our population that has either had the infection or been vaccinated, which is still well off of, you know, what we would consider herd immunity. So to say that we're not vulnerable to the infection at this point is not not an accurate statement, I don't think, by any stretch. But I will say, having 10%, you know, we're only a little bit more than a month into this vaccination process, and having 10% of our population vaccinated in that amount of time is pretty impressive. So I think that, you know, I'm sure we're going to talk about some of the opportunities coming up. As far as I know, there's a citywide vaccine clinic on Friday. You know, we're going to be getting more vaccine in the clinics coming in February. So, you know, I think there's lots of exciting things to be excited for, but certainly it's too early to say, let's let our guard down.
So have you, either of you, had any experience with the vaccination clinic part of things or with vaccinations in the last couple of weeks?
I can speak only for what I've experienced. You know, I know we had Dr. Theobald is typically on the show. She could definitely speak more to how the mass vaccination clinic went, but I did speak to her a little bit and about it. And, you know, it sounds like that was a success. They got 200 vaccines given within four or six hours, which was awesome. Our clinic has kind of taken the response of, we only got so much of the vaccine for the course of January. And, like we have 200 doses for the month of January. So we could give that in clinic just on a daily basis and get through all of it in the month of January. So we kind of took the approach this time of kind of just sort of giving it as part of our typical services that we provide here in clinic. But when we get more, we might be forced to do more of the sort of these mass vaccine clinics that sort of help bump up the rate at which we give them. Because in February, we're not only going to be giving the vaccines we get that month, but we're also going to be giving the second doses of the people that were vaccinated last month. So it's kind of a compounding thing where we have to be able to give more.
And Canada has been doing vaccine services. We were allocated a number of them through Indian Health Services, but they're very limited. We can only give them to Native beneficiaries. And so it somewhat ties our hands on the number of people we can give it to. Being honest with you, we're trying to use up vaccine as quickly as possible so that if they see you still have vaccine left, they're less likely to give you more. And so we're really pushing people to come in and get vaccinated as quick as possible, and actually calling up a number of people and telling them to come in so that we, frankly, it's one of those times where we want to run out of this as quickly as possible. And so we are targeting people who are high risk first, of course, but we're going after people who are even in their 20s at this point, just to use up the vaccine as quickly as possible.
Well, and let me, I think I talked about this 2 weeks ago, Mike, but this is where there's a lot of, I think, communication within the community, is that, and maybe even can speak to this, but Indian Health Service related vaccines within CANA is able to delineate how they give those out, versus for our clinic, we're getting them from the state. We can only give those vaccines to people 65 and older. Like, we are told that that's the population we can give them to. So just so that I feel like in a small community, you know, we get a lot of questions about stuff like that. And so I just wanted to clarify that too.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough point on our side too, because I have some veterans who are 70 and who have had cancer who I can't give a vaccine to because they're not a Native beneficiary. But I have a 25-year-old who has hypertension, who's otherwise in relatively good health, who I can. And so it is a tough situation, but the rules are a little bit different with Indian Health Service's vaccinations. that we are trying to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible. And the truth of the matter is, even when you are vaccinating a 25-year-old, you are helping the elders in this community by cutting out one more vector that can spread it to them. And so it's not a perfect world, but we're doing the best we can with it.
And Mike, I just wanted to put a plug in here, you know, for those that would like the vaccine that are in that 65 and older category, you know, they're welcome to call our clinic. They're welcome to call the ambulatory care clinic. They're welcome to call that number, or there's the website. I wish I had it with me, but they're trying to give out 50 vaccines on Friday. You know, the EOC, Public Health Nursing, is trying to give out 350 vaccines down by the Harbor Master's office. And so I'd really encourage people to look at those resources to try and, you know, let's say you are a patient that goes to Mill Bay Health Center, but aren't able to get it through that, then try and look at, there's other resources potentially in town where you can get that. So we don't want to discourage you from getting the vaccine just because of limitations on either any one of our clinics. So.
Well, tell me about the challenges that you have if you're anticipating this second wave coming in for their second shot, though. It just seems to me to be a big problem if people don't show up to get their second shot and you open a vial and then you're left with vaccine. I mean, you know, you have to kind of, with the storage requirements of this and the shelf life of it, doesn't that make it really challenging to try and eke out what you need, keep what you need, and, you know, and then you got six left, you know, you just call somebody off the street? I mean, how does that work?
Well, I think we have, you know, we have some strategies for that. We have a wait list of people that, you know, kind of know that they're able to come in if we have extra. You know, the state's been really clear with us that they don't want us wasting vaccine. And so if we get to the point where we have a vial open, we can't get people, you know, we can't find people, or basically people in the age range we need to be in, they say, you know, make sure that vaccine doesn't go wasted. And so we have some strategies we're putting in to try and help with that. But, we're trying not to waste.
So I guess my question is then, for people that aren't in the age category that's necessary, is there a second wait list that they could get on to say, look, you know, I'm here, I want this, call me. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of jump the line, you know what I mean?
I just had a patient the other day who got put on a wait list, and I want to say it was at the ambulatory care clinic. He'd called in 3 days before at 5:00. They said, hey, if you can come right now, we got a vaccine for you. And so there are plenty of wait lists where if there's even a little bit left over, there are long wait lists for people to come in who can come in, you know, drop everything and come in and get immunized. And I think all the clinics are doing that. We're not going to waste any of this.
Great.
Yeah. I think every clinic has their own way of dealing with it. But essentially what we've done is when people call in for it, if they're in the age range that is currently acceptable, is currently recommended, then we're putting them on one wait list because that is, or scheduling them for an appointment if we have vaccine. But then if they're below the age limit, then we put them on another wait list where when it opens up, we can call them. So.
So are we all dealing, both of you dealing primarily with the Pfizer vaccine now?
That's what we have. We don't have the Moderna vaccine. We just have the Pfizer.
We have some of both.
Oh. So now I remember from a few weeks ago, there was some, you know, you can mix and match. And then I heard you're not supposed to mix and match. But now it appears again that mix and match is okay.
Technical answer is you're not supposed to mix and match. But if you accidentally mix and match, you technically would be considered immunized at that point. The recommendation is that you do not mix and match, that you pick one company and stick with that company, because we frankly don't know if you have a Pfizer for your first one and a Moderna for your second one. That study has never been done. So we don't know for sure, but they're similar enough with the same target protein that we feel like, yeah, you're probably immunized, but we have no study proving that.
So in your general practice, we keep hearing people are lining up, they want the vaccine. Are you still having to counsel people on the value of taking the vaccine, or is there resistance that you're seeing in your practice from parts of the community to even getting immunized?
I think that the initial response that I've seen has primarily been, again, we're only vaccinating people that are 65 and older. And I think that in general, the 65 and older crowd is pretty excited about getting the vaccine. There's exceptions to that, obviously, but like in general, that age demographic, I think, doesn't need to be convinced that this is something that COVID-19 is something that could be harmful to their health. And so thus far in my scenario where I have, generally people have been excited about getting the vaccine. Now, not universally, but vast majority. I think it's gonna be probably more challenging as you get younger. And I don't know if Evan can speak to that, but I imagine that there's gonna be a little bit more challenge in getting people vaccinated as we go younger and healthier, because people are gonna say, well, this isn't something that's gonna help me.
Yeah, I think it is something that there's a lot of misinformation out there, and we've discussed that on previous shows. There's a lot of people who have podcasts who really don't know what they're talking about. I was sent a video just the other day by a patient, and I watched it, and you quickly realize this guy has a very superficial knowledge of this, and it's purporting himself to be an expert in the field, and it scares people. And just like I frankly don't want to scare people into doing the right thing, what I believe to be the right thing, I try not to raise alarm about COVID to the point where people are scared and anxious. I really just want to be encouraging of people. But the scare tactic does seem to work with people, and people have been scared away from this vaccine. And I have counseled people on pretty much a daily basis. I've had one or two people that I've spent time counseling about my view on the vaccine. And sometimes as many as five people in a day I'm counseling about the vaccine. I have some pretty strong opinions about it, and I think spreading as good information as possible about it is necessary, but I think there's some people who have made up their minds and they're never going to get it no matter what the information is.
It's unfortunate, but how do we achieve, victory over the virus if we don't, if we don't reach those numbers that Dr. Fauci keeps talking about for herd immunity? That means people have to contract the virus, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think, this is not an unusual conversation for us as healthcare professionals to have with patients. I mean, we talk with, specifically in children's visit, but even in adult visits, we talk to people about vaccines all the time. And so this is not necessarily, even though there seems to be a greater sense of urgency right now with this particular vaccine, because period and all those things, it's certainly different in that way. And it's certainly different in the fact that it's such a new vaccine, and that's a little different than some of the other vaccines that we encourage people to get. But I think that it's really important to hear people out, why it is that they're not really excited about taking it. Is it merely because it's new? Is it because they heard something on the radio? Is it because they're deathly scared of needles? There's a lot of reasons why people don't want to get a specific medical treatment, whether it's a vaccine or not. And I think it's just really important to come back to providing good education, and encouraging people, sometimes more forcefully than others, but encouraging people towards getting it, because it really is the only way that to kind of get out of this pickle we're in. And so I think that you know, having those conversations on a daily basis with individual patients is really important. Having conversations with the general public in scenarios like this, I really thank you for allowing us to have these opportunities to provide education. But what we do know about the vaccine is it's very safe, it's very effective, and it's really the shot we got to get out of this mess. And the longer we wait, as we've seen, and I know we're going to talk about some of the new strains, by not getting the vaccine out, by having more and more infections, it just increases the rate at which we're going to see mutations, which, you know, makes this whole thing a little bit more complicated. So,
well, it looks like we're in a place where I think the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is supposed to be okayed here sometime in the near future. There was another one down the pipeline that was going to get approved as well. Then you have Chinese vaccines and Russian vaccines now. So it appears like sometime in the near future, we're going to be flooded with a variety of vaccines. Is there any reason why somebody should gravitate toward one more than another, or are they all, you know, if they all come in at 90%, 85% effective, why wouldn't we take anything that's available?
Probably something is better than nothing. Some of these other vaccines are more traditional vaccines where they kind of take the virus and basically chop it up and put it into your body, and your body develops an immune response to it. It's an inactivated virus, but its effectiveness is far less than the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines. I don't know where it's going to come out. I saw numbers anywhere from 50 to 65% effective. And some people thought, well, it's going to actually end up being a little higher than that, but it's not nearly to the levels of this other novel way of approaching a vaccine. But it's using an old technology.
In the long run, though, to be effective towards fighting the vaccine, eliminating the virus, we pretty much have to vaccinate the planet, right? In some phase. I mean, right now our goal is let's protect Kodiak, let's protect Alaska, but we're still going to be affected by what's happening in the U.S. and then, you know, beyond that, what's happening globally. So, you know, how do we effectively get a vaccine to everybody in the planet is a challenge. And then how do you get the vaccine to everybody before it starts to mutate and the vaccine's not as effective as it could be? I mean, doesn't the fact that the UK variant has been found in Alaska now kind of concern you?
Well, there's a lot of questions there, Mike. I think, you know, I'm a big proponent of, you know, taking things one step at a time, because I think if we think too far down the pike, it's just daunting. You know, when I was, training in as a distance runner in college, my college, we do repeat miles, you know, so you do 6 mile repeats for your workout. And if you start thinking about all six, then you just lose it, right? You know, so you got to think at 1 mile at a time. And sometimes when it's really hard, you got to think just one step at a time, right? You know, you got to like break it down. And so I really think that instead of thinking of the big picture, this is a global problem. And it's a national problem, it's a global problem, it's a local problem. And I think that if even and I get too involved in just trying to think of the big picture of the global picture, the national picture, even the statewide picture, then we're not going to serve our patients here in Kodiak as well as we could. And so I think that the first step has to be, we're getting the vaccine. How do we get that into people? How do we get that into as many people in Kodiak as possible, in as efficiently as possible? And really, we have to take that step first, because it's fun to talk about, and we can certainly talk about the variants and how they form and why they're problematic. But in general, on a day-to-day basis, I'm just thinking, how much vaccine are we getting? how do we get it in as efficiently as possible? And that's going to get us closer to our goal. But so that answers the first part of your question. I forget what the second part was, but
I think a big part of it too is the U.S. has been the most generous country in the world. We are givers. We give to causes all the time. We're a generous country. Part of that is we, as a wealthier country, what happens in Ghana affects what happens in the U.S. of A. too. And so these are one of those times where we're going to have to help out some of these poorer countries by helping them with the cost of vaccination and distribution. What happens in a little village in Cambodia can affect what happens here in the U.S. if it starts new strains that are resistant. But if we help people get vaccinated around the world, we are in many ways helping ourselves. And so this is a time where we're going to have to be stewards to the entire world and serve the people around the entire world. And I think it's something that we've been good about in the past when there's been natural disasters or famines, and we need to continue that into the future.
And I would argue, though, it's not just for charity even. It's actually, I think, indirectly going to be beneficial to.
Oh, it's totally self-centered.
I think that it's good that to be generous and these things, but it's not only just that. It's actually, I think that it's going to help us battle this virus locally and domestically as well. So,
popped up on my phone, covidvax.alaska.gov. That's the address that people should go to if they don't call one of the clinics to make an appointment for this vaccination clinic that's happening later this week. So you can call your local clinic or go to that website. That's where it's at. Well, let's talk a little bit about, I just want to ask this. The CEO of Moderna, I believe yesterday, came out and talked about Moderna's ability to effectively deal with the variants that are out there now, particularly the UK one and the Brazilian one, the South African one. I think they're still having some sort of conflict about whether or not it's effective or not. So is it because the Pfizer folks maybe don't know? If they work exactly the same way, wouldn't you think that the Pfizer one would be as effective on the variants as the Moderna one? Or, would that steer somebody, if they had an option, to go towards the Moderna if they had an option?
So I think what he was speaking on is actually that we can do boosters that will effectively treat these variants. I compared this vaccine to being a drill in the past. That right now the drill bit that we have on it is for the current COVID-19, but there's going to be variants, and it doesn't mean inventing a whole new drill. It means that we might have to change the bit out for a slightly larger bit. And so we don't have to reinvent the wheel. This is a fairly easy thing that we modify the mRNA that's in these vaccines so that now your body's printing the correct protein now that it's mutated a little bit and our body doesn't recognize this mutation. That hasn't been an issue so far. And we think there's effectiveness with probably both vaccines against these variants. But we don't know. We haven't tested it exactly how effective they are, but we do believe that they're effective against the variants. They chose a part of the virus that's universal among all of them and isn't going to likely change too significantly, too quickly. And I think they're pretty smart about what they chose. But eventually there will come a day where probably if we don't get this virus dampened down, there will be mutations that are resistant to this vaccination, and you will need a booster of something else. And that's the importance of getting people vaccinated as quick as possible so we don't have these variants.
Yeah. And maybe I'll just add to that, I think there's also like, this is not usually like an on or off switch. Like a lot of times, just because, to use the drill bit analogy, maybe it's a different size of a Phillips head or, you know, something like that, that you can still work, but maybe it's not quite as effective as maybe, you know, the initial studies show that there's, the vaccine's 90 to 95% effective. Maybe with this new strain, it's, you know, 70% effective or something, you know, like it's not usually going to be like a, it works or doesn't work. It's just, it may not work quite as well. But again, I think it's premature to say that just because we don't know, like the studies haven't been done. So I think that all this is a bit of, you know, guesswork on that regard.
So in the long term, does it seem reasonable to think that once you get vaccinated now, for the next few years, we're going to be going in and getting like a flu shot booster type thing to deal with the variants because we haven't eliminated the virus yet and it's going to keep mutating, right?
I think it's kind of hard to say exactly what that's going to look like. I think it's possible. It's definitely possible.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, kids and why. I mean, I understand that kids were not as affected as much as adults. So we didn't include them in the original trials. But now if we want to reach herd immunity through vaccination, at some point in time, don't kids have to be included in the vaccinations?
I mean, they're definitely a vector, and we're definitely going to have to address it someday. But I don't think it's necessary right away that if the adults kind of take on the vaccine, we can cut off enough of the vector that we could effectively stop this virus. But it requires as many adults getting vaccinated as possible. The problem is we just haven't tested in people 15 or younger. It's not that it could be harmful. It's not that it's not effective. It's just we don't know. And until we test it in kids who are 15 or younger, we can't really speak on it to, you know, whether it's safe or effective or whatever. Kids about 11 to 15 are pretty similar for transmitting as adults. 11 or younger, they seem to transmit it. They can transmit it, but at a lower level. And so I think eventually there is going to be vaccination for kids, and I think they're working towards that.
So as we know now, if somebody gets infected with COVID one strain, they can become reinfected with a different strain and have worse symptoms than they had the first time. And I'm assuming maybe that works with kids as well. So if the virus continues to mutate, it seems to me like, you know, we don't really know what's going to happen to kids with a different variant in the future, right?
It's true. I mean, it's this whole idea of virus mutation, you know, I think it's just really interesting because what a virus needs to mutate is just to be put under pressure. And so if every time the virus infects somebody, there's a certain amount of pressure for the virus to try and escape whatever immunity is given. And so I think that this is one of those things that where I think there's a lot of misconception in the public where it's like, well, you know, if I'm young and healthy, the likelihood, or a kid, you know, they're not likely to get very sick. And so who cares? Why are we doing all these things? But one of the big downsides of having just florid infections throughout our country and world is that the virus, it just gives the virus that many more times to be able to mutate. And so, I think that eventually, obviously, I think eventually this is going to be there's going to be a vaccine, whether it's the ones we have now or whether it's a different one, that is going to be for kids. And I think that time is coming. I think it makes a lot of sense, though, to vaccinate the people first that are most vulnerable. And so I think that it's not that kids won't be a part of this in the future, but I think that for right now, it hasn't been studied on kids. And so I think we're really focusing on these higher risk populations.
Well, let me ask you about, you know, there's a population of kids though that are at higher risk for serious infection. I mean, would you consider a kid with pre-existing conditions, if the vaccine was available to the, if a parent came in and said, you know, my child has asthma, my child has diabetes, whatever, you know, and you had extra vaccine available, would you vaccinate that child?
Well, I think that that's not a problem we have right now because we don't have enough vaccine to give. But I think that I would want to, at this point, like I wouldn't do it because we have enough vaccine in the age groups that we're trying to define, and we don't have good safety data for kids. So I guess I would, it's kind of a little bit of a cop out, but we don't have that scenario. We have enough people that want it, that are in the age groups that are available. Now, I'm sure that the American Academy of Pediatrics, or when the time comes where we have more vaccine than we have people to give it to that are in the age ranges and kids become part of that target, I'm sure there will be recommendations that come out. I'm not aware of any. I'm not sure if it even is.
I'm unaware of any kids getting this vaccine at this point. The data just isn't there. If I had extras, if I had more than I could use, I still would not vaccinate a kid at this time, even if they're high risk. My recommendation would be, let's get everybody in the household vaccinated, and that way we protect this kid. Because this needs to be done in a controlled setting. And I can be a shooting from the hip kind of guy at times and say, yeah, we can give this a try. It's probably not going to hurt you. This is not a case where I would do that. I wouldn't be interested in experimenting with something like this.
Well, ethically, I'm just wondering, historically, how did we test prior vaccinations on young people? Because here, you know, if you're in a clinical setting and you can put your hand up and know all the risks and volunteer to be a clinical, you know, an experiment for a new vaccine, a new drug, whatever. But if you're a kid, you don't have that ability to make the choice yourself. You have to have a parent make it for you. Why would a parent actually volunteer their kid to go into a study like this so that we could even develop something? How did they do it for polio? Mm-hmm. Okay. It was one of those questions that just popped up in my head.
It's quite a moral quandary to put our kids, what we perceive as being in danger from something that's unknown. But there are a lot of things known about this vaccine, and there are a lot of things known about the disease itself. And it's, the disease is not a joke, and it does cause permanent damage to some people. Younger kids do tend to have an easier time of it, but we don't know all the damage that's going to be done in the future. When we see the numbers of post-COVID syndrome, I don't think we have quite a great idea what it is in kids, whether they fully recover or if there's issues. But to me, the 0.5% death is not the significant concern there. It's the comorbidities that go with it. With poor circulation, we have kids whose toes are turning blue because they're getting clotted. They're having blood clots shower down on them. What's that doing to their lungs? What's that doing to their heart? What's that doing to their brain? Those are pretty scary scenarios too. And some people may feel like, you know, I don't want my kid to experience that, so I'm going to take a chance on the vaccine. It would be a tough decision though. Even in my household, my kids are all pretty much adults at this point, but I've said, you know, you got to make your own decision on what you want to do with it. These are the facts as I know it though. None of my kids are under 16 though.
So we've talked a lot about vaccines. Are there any developments that you're aware of now that look hopeful for treatment? I mean, I've heard some new antibody treatments that people are using now that seem to be more promising than what's been used in the past? But are we still in the same place we were in 6 months ago?
I haven't heard a lot of new information on the treatment side. I know that, you know, from the standpoint of what someone would get if they came in locally to the hospital, it's pretty much going to be the dexamethasone steroids and the remdesivir, which is, you know, the FDA-approved medicine for people that are more acutely ill. And then just oxygen and some different techniques to help with that. So I've not heard anything new. I'm not sure, you know, I think my focus has been much more on getting the vaccine out the last few weeks. So I will say that I'm not necessarily haven't been reading the literature on that regard as much as I was about a month ago. But Ethan, have you heard anything new?
Yeah, so there's a combined antibody treatment. They just had a study put out like 2 days ago. That showed that it cut down on hospitalizations by about 70%. They're not sure that it even cuts down on the length of the illness, but it seems to cut down on the severity of the illness fairly significantly. And I can't even remember what the two antibody treatments are, but it's done as an outpatient. Unfortunately, I think it's an IV treatment. And so that the logistics of it become much more complex when it's not a pill form that we can prescribed to a patient, but we actually have to have an IV hooked up and give them antibodies in order to protect them. It's also extremely expensive at this point, but it may get cheaper into the future as we get better at producing it. You know, talking about the variants, the variant that kind of was happening in Brazil is already becoming resistant to some of these antibody treatments. I don't know about this specific one, but that was the concern, is it's becoming somewhat resistant to even these antibody treatments.
And then I would like to say that as of now, these antibody treatments, and the antibody treatments are primarily meant for people that are not so sick that they're actually in the hospital. So they're kind of treatments for people that are outpatients. At this point, those are not available in Kodiak unless there's something that I'm not aware of. And part of it is the logistics of it. You know, you're asking a patient that is COVID positive to come into a facility in order to give them these antibody treatments. And the way that, at least at the hospital, the way that the outpatient infusion center, that's where all of our chemotherapy patients go and all these different things. So the logistics of trying to do that was quite intensive. And there was worry that it might unduly expose people that are perhaps the most vulnerable. And so just to be aware that the antibody treatments right now are not something that we are offering here in Kodiak for a lot of different logistical reasons. But I think there's a lot of work being done in this regard and many things that I'm not aware of. I don't think there's been a huge movement in for what we do as far as treatment for COVID patients.
So what we know about these variants so far is that they're not increasing the severity of the illness or the death rate, right? I mean, it appears like they're just speeding up the transmission of the disease, which is problematic because that the more people that have it, of course, then the percentages are still there for who's going to get really sick and who's going to die. So that's a bit problematic, but just because the variant are we afraid of a variant that's going to increase the severity of the disease?
So the thing about variants is they need to transmit. And so a variant that causes death quickly is not beneficial for the virus because you're killing off your host there. And so we tend to have these more mild, highly transmissible variants, and this new variant out of South Africa and Britain, there's been some studies have said that it's not any more harmful. It's just, we look back and talk about the spike protein. It adheres to something called an ACE2 receptor that in this case, it adheres about 70% stronger than the original wild type. And so it's easier to get it connected to the ACE2 receptor and makes it a little higher transmissibility. There's been some people who felt like it is slightly more deadly. But we don't know for sure at this point. We haven't seen a significant difference between them. And part of that, it's understudied. I mean, here in Kodiak, we just don't look at the, we just say COVID positive or negative. We don't know what kind of COVID you have. We just know it's positive or negative, and that's it.
Yeah. And I would say that the other thing to add on to that is, even if it's slightly less deadly, if it's like two times more contagious, then you're going to end up with a problem, right? Because, like, you know, let's say it's a 10% less severe, but then you have double the amount of people to get sick. You're still going to end up with more people in the hospital, more people dying because of just the contagious rate. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see how this develops. I think that like even said, there's not really a we don't have a final answer on this, but in general, as viruses mutate, they tend to get more contagious and usually a little bit less virulent. So a little less severe in their illness. Generally, that's a trend, but we just don't know in this particular virus.
Well, it's going to be a race till to get everybody vaccinated before before we know exactly what's going to happen. So the week ahead for you two, are you looking, do you look day to day or do you look like a week, a month down the road to figure out where you're at?
I'm so bad about planning ahead. I'm terrible about it. There's times where the night before I have to look at my schedule and find what time I'm supposed to show up the next day. So I'm, and there's been days where I thought I had the next day off and I look at the schedule and realize, oh man, I'm working tomorrow. I'm terrible about planning ahead. Dr. Kletnikoff, who works here, has her vacations worked out for the next 2 years. And I'm so bad. I'm like, man, it'd be nice to have tomorrow off. I'm not so good at planning ahead. So I do take it day by day. And it kind of bites me at times, but I'm not a stressed out person, I guess, because I don't worry about it too much. It all seems to work out in the end.
How about you, Dr. Mortensen?
I'm definitely more of a day by day type person. That's why I'm blessed with a wife that plans ahead for me. She kind of keeps me on the hook for those types of things. But I kind of expressed my philosophy on, I think taking it a day at a time is important. I think that if we get too far ahead of ourselves, then it gets starting looking pretty pretty murky, pretty depressing at times. But I think that if we just take it a day at a time, do the best we can every day, then I think things are going to work out. So
you guys have a great day and a great week and a great month, and I hope it's a good year. And I thank you again for your time. Thanks for spending your morning with us.
Hey, thanks for having us.
All right, you guys have a good week. We'll see you next week.
Take care. Bye.
All right, everybody. Again, remember, Monday, a special edition of The Lowdown, talking with the Medical Center Administration folks. Have a good day for you all, too.